When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And I'm going to focus tonight on looking at the use of poison gas on the Western Front, particularly in the final year of the war, 1918. We're looking at David Stevenson's brilliant book, With Our Backs to the Wall. We've looked at David Stevenson's work quite a lot over the last couple of years. And we're looking at really how over the 3 years since 1915, when gas was first used, how on all sides the technology of mass poisoning, to put it bluntly, had changed. David Stevenson begins by saying, "The necessary technology had evolved astonishingly rapidly since the Germans had released chlorine from cylinders to be blown by the wind in April 1915. The tonnages were now vastly greater. The principal delivery method was via artillery, and the highest casualties came from mustard gas, which was dichlorodiethyl sulfate, or Ypres, which was the French term after the various battles of Ypres. Of gas tonnage employed by all sides in the war, 52% was used in the final year, and some 17,000 men who died from gas on the Western Front, about 3% of the total fatalities in that theatre, about half died so in 1918. So those are some pretty astonishing stats, really, that the majority of all gas fatalities happened in the last year of the war, and of all gas fatalities, half of those died in 1918. It gives you an indication of the concentration of gas use and also the intensity of fighting, and the desperation with which both sides were willing to use any weapon imaginable in order to finally conclude the war one way or another. David Stevenson writes, "The Germans remained the pace setters. During the war, they released 52,000 tons of poison gas, their usage rising tenfold between 1915 and 1917, nearly doubling again in 1918. In comparison, France released 26,000 tons, Britain 14,000, Austria-Hungary 7,900, Italy 6,300, Russia 4,700, and the USA 1,000. 70% of the British, French and German gas casualties occurred in 1918, but Germany's total for the year of 70,000 killed and wounded was much less than for its opponents, Britain 114,000, France 110,000. And the remarkably high US figure of 75,700. Between July 1917 and June 1918, the Germans alone could mass produce mustard gas, and this was symptomatic of their leading chemical warfare based on a larger and more diversified pre-1914 chemical industry than any of their opponents except the United States." So this is indeed the case. Now, if you ever read the brilliant book Hell's Cartel by Dermot Jeffries, it's a history of the chemical cartel IG Farben, and their involvement in the Holocaust, their complicity in the Holocaust. But it's also kind of a history of Germany's chemical industry and the development of chemicals as a kind of a key part of German industrialism, which outstripped Great Britain until really the 1920s and the establishment of Imperial Chemical Industries, ICI. Ironically, the product of two German companies. Erich von Ludendorff was a key proponent of gas warfare, quite an enthusiast for it. And he had relations, he had good contacts with Fritz Haber, who was the head of the Kaiser Wilhelm Research Institute in Berlin, later one of the IG Farben kind of most significant figures in IG Farben. And Ludendorff didn't really need much persuading in the efficacy of gas as a battlefield weapon. Gas could be discharged from cylinders via shells, from a projector, which was a type of light mortar. The British introduced the Livens projector in April 1917, and the Germans copied it, making gas artillery more mobile, more flexible as a weapon. German projectors particularly did a lot of harm at the Battle of Caporetto, where faulty Italian gas masks rendered them basically useless. On the Western Front, though, the German projector was much more accurate than the Allied one and longer than the British Livens projector. And so its projectile could carry less of the gas, which was in order to achieve fatal concentrations. But this in itself had a kind of a battlefield use. If you killed, say, five soldiers, then that's five soldiers out of the picture. If you poison five soldiers, another number of soldiers are required to remove them from the battlefield, or you have the possibility of potentially poisoning and incapacitating more than, say, five soldiers. So actually wounding as a tool is more useful than actual fatalities, because often the gas victims were so badly injured by the gas that they weren't going to be returning to the battlefield perhaps at any point. The Germans, after June 1918, abandoned the projectors and returned to artillery shells. Shells, in the view of the German High Command, were better because they required they were less reliant on the wind blowing in the right direction. And they were used as a counter-battery weapon that required less accuracy than high explosive, because obviously you're creating a cloud of gas as opposed to pinpointing artillery positions with high explosive shells. The Germans had three different colours of gas. They had yellow mustard gas, green diphosgene gas, and the blue gas, an arsenic-based agent, and a dye that would kind of irritate the nose and throat, forcing the enemy soldiers to remove their masks and thus exposing them to a kind of lethal nerve agents. This was referred to as the German colour cross system, and it was very complex. The German frontline troops were often unaware of which gas was which and what they were being used for, and so often this was used sparingly and was a kind of a device for major set-piece battles. The Blue Cross device, the blue gas known as Blue Cross, once the Allies realised the trick, once they told the soldiers, no, it doesn't matter if your skin becomes irritated, keep your mask on. In many cases, the Blue Cross gas didn't work. Often the explosive charge within the shell that would launch the gas into the atmosphere once the shell had exploded, wasn't powerful enough really to pulverise these various substances finely enough for it to be inhaled. And millions of Blue Cross shells that the Germans manufactured turned out to be a waste of resources. The diphosgene gas was very, very effective, very, very deadly, and much more deadly than chlorine gas. Mustard gas was a blistering agent that attacked the skin, particularly where it was moist, the eyes, producing intense pain and temporary blindness, although it was rarely lethal in the first instance. It might disable victims permanently, particularly if it was inhaled, causing terrible damage to the lungs. In 1918, the Germans added a charge of high explosive to the mustard shells in order to reduce the warning time by eliminating the distinctive kind of plopping noise when the shell detonated. So by doing this, they reduced how much gas the shell could carry. And by scattering the gas more widely, they reduced its concentration. However, neither gas masks nor anything else, nor any other kind of protection, was much use against mustard gas. It would stay in the air for days and even weeks in cold and dry conditions. It contaminated the ground, it drenched, and it couldn't be fired in front of infantry. So if you were leading an infantry charge and you wanted to disable your enemy, you couldn't use it because your infantry would march straight into it because it sits still in the air. But it could be used to seal off the flanks of an attack. So if you're being attacked by from one side or the other, you can create essentially a wall of mustard gas to protect your flank, protect your rear. And the less useful blue and green gases could be used straight ahead of your army because they responded in fundamentally different ways. So in a way, once the British worked out what the blue, the green and the yellow gases were for, they could plot what it was. The German generals were giving big sort of colour-coded visual signifiers to what they intended. So, you know, once you crack the code, it was a giveaway in some regards. The biggest German success with gas came in along the Schemmingen Dam on the 27th of May 1918. Up to 50% of the munitions that were fired were chemical. This was the highest proportion in any of the offensives of the war. They smothered the Allied artillery and terrified the infantry. A favourable wind drove the cloud on ahead. So that in itself is an extraordinary statistic. If you think about all the battles of the war, all the artillery poundings that took place, this one battle, 50% of all munitions fired by Germany were chemical weapons, were gas shells. It shows you how the level of faith that Ludendorff was placing on gas at that particular during that particular wave of the last offensives of the war in order to break through Allied lines. The initial victory owed much to gas, at least. This helped to scatter the Portuguese Allied army. Mustard gas was also used intensively at this battle, producing lines of blinded Allied servicemen at casualty clearing stations. And the mustard gas bombardments followed the Allies throughout this campaign, forcing them to abandon several key positions, particularly Armentieres.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The kind of the iconic image of the war when it comes to the use of poison gas is the painting Gassed by John Singer Sargent, which you can see at the special collections at the Imperial War Museum. It's a magnificent piece of work that shows a line of Allied soldiers marching towards a casualty clearing station. In the background, it's a fascinating painting, because in the background you can see the Allied soldiers nonchalantly playing football, writing letters, having a smoke, that kind of thing. British soldiers, they were. As if the horrific scene of blinded men hanging on to each other's shoulders was a kind of a piece of the everyday, you know, nothing particularly remarkable, which obviously the kind of the truth that the painting tries to tell is that is indeed the case, and that these things were kind of part of the everyday towards the end of the war. David Stevenson writes, "The most important Allied countermeasures were defensive. The French by 1918 had replaced their hopelessly deficient M2 respirator with the Ark, which, however, was still outmatched by the British SBR small-box respirator, the best design of the war. In addition, the British Special Brigades, led by Charles Fulkes, the BEF's British Expeditionary Forces Director of Gas Services, attacked the Germans using cylinders and Livens projectors, of which the British Expeditionary Force had 200,000 by March 1918. German troops much feared the latter, as prisoner testimony confirmed. For only 25 seconds after the warning ignition flash, the descending canisters would fill the trenches with lethal concentrations. These, however, were harassing attacks, conducted in quiet sectors between the main battles, often against units that were resting. In the battles themselves, while on the defensive, the Allies could mount few big counterattacks, nor could they counter mustard with mustard. Although they quickly identified the substance the Germans were using, the British took much longer to evolve a cheap and efficient method of mass producing it. Clemenceau made it a matter of the highest priority, and the French first used mustard gas in June 1918. The British, not until September. Hence, a defensive weapon par excellence was unavailable to the Allies in their greatest need, while the tens of thousands of casualties wreaked by German mustard gas exacerbated their manpower crisis. Now, again, this tells an interesting story about the last year of the war. As David Stevenson points out there, as far as the Germans were concerned, mustard gas was a defensive weapon. It created a huge toxic barrier that forced enemy soldiers to retreat or kept enemy soldiers from advancing. The British and the French in the first half of 1918 are flung back by the various Ludendorff spring offensives, Blücher, York, Michel, and so on and so forth. And throughout most of the year, We're desperately in need of the kind of device, like mustard gas, that would simply have stopped the German army, as sufficient amounts of mustard gas, hideous though it is to say, certainly would have done. The manpower crisis that the Allies faced was there and present. The whole kind of benefit of having American servicemen turning up in Europe was that they were going to address the exhaustion of the Allied armies, the huge numbers of prisoners taken during the spring offensive, and the gradual attrition of the strength of Allied armies towards the end of the year. When Allied armies went forward in the last few months of the war, last 3 or 4 months of the war, they faced an enemy that still possessed large quantities of gas. The Germans experienced some shortages in the summer of 1918, but not of mustard gas. And only until the final weeks did the supplies of mustard gas break down. And the German colour coding system broke down as the German army descended into chaos. As the German army retreated, they fired off their blue cross gas, which didn't do very much, and the yellow mustard gas, which did a significant amount, particularly at the, for example, at the Battle of Albert on the 21st to the 23rd of August, that led to some of the highest British casualties ever. The Allies on the move had placed Germany in a position of such acute desperation that they were willing to go to bet the house on gas, basically, and to cause as much loss of life and as much bloodshed as possible in order to slow the Allied advance down in any way. The Allied armies on the move were in a kind of a slightly more vulnerable position. Armies moving at a fairly rapid pace often have fewer defensive positions to hide behind when weapons like gas are used against them. The sense that the British had was that the Germans were disposing of their remaining stocks of gas using as much of it as possible. And finally, by the final weeks of the war, the danger from gas gradually declined, though the American injuries from gas, American casualties from gas, were enormously high. The final view of the British was that despite all the bloodshed from gas, despite all the losses from gas, it still didn't particularly slow down the Allied advance, and perhaps this shows the kind of the inevitability of the downfall of Germany at the end of the war. Britain and France didn't mass produce gas before the war. The British managed to raise their chlorine production tenfold by 1918, and with phosgene gas particularly, the French did significantly bigger numbers than that. The British never really had enough phosgene, but the French supplied it to them, and the British Expeditionary Force used a gas called chloropicrin, which was significantly less deadly than phosgene and than mustard gas. By 1918, for the first time, the British had gas shells in quantities and varieties that were needed. The weather and the situation became the main obstacles, the way in which the wind blew, and as mentioned, the difficulties of an army on the move being able to kind of adopt and manage to find themselves defensive positions. The Allies never discharged mustard gas on the quantities that the Germans did. And by 1918, the German gas mask was starting to reach some significant problems. Germany was running out of the rubber that was needed for the valves And the fabric then had to be substituted with leather, which was much less effective. The mask generally became useless if it was worn for more than a few hours. The British SBR, small box respirator, had no problems in that regard and could be worn for quite a long time. And there's clear evidence that by the summer of 1918, the British Expeditionary Force is using poison gas in a highly battlefield effective manner. For example, at the Battle of Hamel on the 4th of July, British howitzers fired over 25,000 gas shells in the morning, which managed to silence Germany's batteries and created a barrier against a counterattack, much as the Germans had done with mustard gas. While the special brigades, the British Expeditionary Force special brigades, used Leven's projectors against the German guns on the adjoining heights, on the high ground nearby. The French used gas shells before the counterattack at Villers-Cotterêts on the 18th of July. And on the 8th of August, both the British and French forces used them at the Battle of Amiens, which was referred to as the Black Day for the German army. The Battle of Amiens is the point at which Ludendorff and Hindenburg tell the Kaiser that the jig is up and the war is basically lost. So we'll hopefully look at this in a little bit more depth in the future. It's kind of a particularly repugnant topic area. But then again, if you compare the effect of mass artillery and the other various means of destruction during the war, gas is no better and no worse, really. The experience of gas during the war had a long, particularly psychological hold on British and German and French psyches through the interwar years. There was the terror that the British had was that gas would be dropped on British cities in the outbreak of another war with Germany. And gas, as a weapon of mass destruction, has been a kind of a key part of various treaties and various kind of arms limitation talks and various conventions on the legalities of warfare. But it's worth remembering, of course, that artillery killed vastly more soldiers than gas ever managed during the war. Anyway, thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast in these strange and turbulent and peculiar times. Do check us out on the Explaining History Patreon page. There's always extra content there for subscribers, and I'll see you all soon. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.